Welcome to the BRAD Podcast, where we explore ways to pursue peak performance with passion throughout life without taking ourselves too seriously. I'm Brad Kearns, New York Times bestselling author, former number 3 world-ranked professional triathlete, and Guinness World Record Masters athlete. I connect with experts in diet, fitness, and personal growth, and deliver short breather shows where you get simple, actionable tips to improve your life right away. Let's explore beyond the hype, hacks, shortcuts, and sciencey talk to laugh, have fun, and appreciate the journey. It's time to be rad.
Now, how about can you do it with, 5 billion people watching? That's the challenge at the end of it, and that's why.
Greetings, my fitness-minded listeners. I want to acquaint you with the Primal Fitness Expert Certification Program, the most comprehensive home study multimedia fitness education course in the world. If you want to enhance your personal knowledge of all aspects of leading a healthy, active, fit lifestyle, this total immersion course will be life-changing. I'm the lead instructor and author of the course, and we have 14 chapters of extensive written content with over 100 accompanying videos covering topics such as general everyday movement, including micro workouts and dynamic workstation tips, the full experience of gym-based strength training and all the different modalities, a complete presentation on all aspects of sprinting, both running and low impact options, an assortment of high intensity interval training and high intensity repeat training strategies, a detailed education on the principles and practical application of aerobic endurance training, and extensive commentary, the most you will find in any publication, on all aspects and symptoms of overtraining and burnout. We even have fascinating peripheral topics like integrating nasal diaphragmatic breathing, dynamic stretching, injury prevention, and developing a peak performance mindset. It's really something, this course. We went all out for over 2 years with a great team to develop this amazing home-based fitness education for you. And you get one-on-one expert email support and private Facebook group connection throughout your studies to ensure that you absorb everything optimally and you pass your series of exams and get certified. So go to primalhealthcoach.com/Brad to enjoy a very special limited time. And I'm not kidding. This is a big time discount just for you. 25% off your tuition. A fantastic premium offer at primalhealthcoach.com/Brad for the most comprehensive fitness course you can ever find. Hey, listeners, I'm so excited to introduce a unique and super interesting and super lively talkative guest. His name is Otto Bolden, and track and field fans will recognize him as one of the fastest humans of all time. He competed back in the 90s for Trinidad and Tobago, representing them in 3 Olympic Games. He has 8 global medals. In the Atlanta Olympics, he went bronze in the 100-200. In Sydney, he went bronze-silver. He was world champion at 200 meters, so competing at the highest level, running some of the fastest times in human history. And what's really cool about Otto is after he retired from elite competition, he transitioned into an amazing and lengthy career in the broadcast booth, where his performances are certainly rivaling what he did on the track. He has been the lead broadcaster for NBC Track and Field for 17 years, and every broadcast, he is full of energy, excitement, true, honest enthusiasm, and has tremendous knowledge about all aspects of track and field that he shares in a beautiful manner with the audience. I'm not kidding when I consider him to be the single best commentator in the world in any sport. So even if you're not a huge track and field fan and you tune in to listen to Otto throw down his unique style, you are going to enjoy the broadcast tremendously. I was attending the track and field meet in Eugene, Oregon, the Diamond League Finals, one of the greatest track meets ever. And who do I bump into on our airplane flight but the man himself? So I am so excited to
get him on this podcast and talk about his journey as a kid growing up in Trinidad and Tobago and then moving to New York and then later California in high school and excelling in sprinting, but certainly not a world beater as a youth. But he continued to develop. He went over to UCLA. He had a sensational career where he never lost a race to another collegiate athlete. That put him right on the center stage after graduation to his wonderful career on the world stage. It was cut short a little bit early by injury and a terrible automobile accident. But what's nice is how Otto transitioned into his career as announcer. So he's just going to take us through this really interesting story of how athletes can, you know, compete at the highest level, what it's like to be an elite track and field athlete and the economic circumstances and the challenges of being in an individual sport and then transitioning over into the broadcast booth and all the preparation and focus and background research that goes into being a great broadcaster. So, you know, traveling the circuit and being around it and being a coach of numerous elite athletes, and including a lot of NFL players, which you'll talk about in a little bit, Otto really connects well with the athletes, and it shows in his broadcast. I think you're going to get some interesting insights out of this. So, on your marks, get set, go with Otto Bolden. Otto Bolden, I'm so glad to catch up with you. Thank you so much for coming on the BRAD podcast, man. You're a busy guy.
My pleasure to be here. Good thing you caught me in the off season.
That's right. Your schedule is incredible, and it's been so dating all the way back to your days as an athlete. And I think you've made such a beautiful transition to become an announcer. And I've heard you talk before about how your passion is for promoting track and field. And of course, when you're an elite athlete and a world champion, you're doing that on a global stage. But now you've been able to do this for years and years. So, luckily, with my tooth pulled today, I might have a little bit of trouble talking, but I have a very good guest for that reason, because I know we can wind this guy up. Anyone who's seen NBC Sports can dope, but I'd really love to have you take us through your career as a sprinter, starting in Trinidad and Tobago, and then you came to America, you had an amazing career at UCLA, you went pro, and we'll take it all the way up to that graceful transition into the announcing booth.
Well, let me start first by correcting you a little bit. Trinidad and Tobago, so that we don't offend our my twin island sister. What's funny is that if you would have told people that I grew up with in Trinidad, by the time I come back here in 97, which is 9 years, 9 years after I left, that I was going to be the country's first world champion, they'd have probably had you fitted for some sort of straitjacket. I had run with very little success back home, but it was really when I always say my athletic gifts came late, and they did. I was an undersized kid for a long time, maybe until I got to about 15, 16, I moved to New York, I'm playing soccer and get discovered by Joseph Trupiano in Queens, New York. I had always felt like I had the will here to be great, but my body hadn't caught up with my ambition just yet. So I go to New York. I'm playing soccer at a pretty good level there. High school soccer in New York is not bad. There's a lot of immigrant kids, so that certainly raises the level of play, because you have a lot of great kids coming from the islands and sort of meshing with the ones who were already here. But once I sort of discovered that I was any good in 1990, that was it. In 2 years, I was in the Olympics. And it wasn't that I was great early. I was good. 90, I was good. I was third in the state of New York in the 200. And then by the next year, I was third in the state of California, which that's a big difference. I had moved out to California. And then, out to UCLA and the rest, as they say, is history. But I think my passion for track and field is in part because of how global it is. I think as somebody who was an immigrant and discovered the sport here, I think it sort of harkened back to, there's a big wide world out there. I mean, I I love NFL football as much as anybody else. Go Niners, undefeated, 5-0. But nothing tugs at my heartstrings more than track and field. I think in part because I know what it can mean. I mean, look at a country like Barbados, right? Barbados is just to the north and east of Trinidad and Tobago. They have a young lady called Sade Williams who now has won two consecutive 400 meter medals at the World Championships. They are her country's first two medals ever. They're gonna write textbooks about her. And you know, oh, but it's only no, it's like she went from very, very good junior athlete to, you know, where she is now. And it's like, I always kind of had this sense of being able to represent my country. And I think that's what kept me in it, because it wasn't always easy, particularly making that transition from world junior champion to who are you at, you know, in the pro ranks.
That's an interesting comment about your childhood, that you didn't have immediate success, because there's a common notion that when you are looking at the profound genetic gifts required to have that potential to one day be world champion, I would assume on the playground when you're 7 or 8 or 12, that you're torching everyone, you know, without the training or the coaching or the components that come in later to get you down from, you know, the raw gifts that you see. What's the story, the tale of two high jumpers that David Epstein tells, Donald Thomas, where they took him off the basketball court, took him out to the track in his high tops, and he jumps 7 feet the first time he sees a bar. You would assume that's certainly the case for a 100-meter sprinter, if no other athlete.
You would, if you saw the hill on which I grew up, which seems like as steep a hill as anybody grew up on, you would think, okay, so there's some conditioning here. I used to run up and down that hill as though it was flat. And I go back there now. I mean, I am 50 this year, but I go back there now and I go, geez. I mean, not run up at 20, 30, 40%. It was a flat out sprint. And I think to myself, how many times did you run up this very long, very steep hill? It's almost like you see those goats that are born on the side of a cliff, and you're holding your breath because you go, huh? But to the goat, that's the only life it knows. Mm. So I feel like I was being conditioned to potentially be this great athlete one day because it was in there. But like I said, I had to wait because it was, I think it's read across some old video the other day where I was sort of fooling around with a camcorder that last day of my senior year, and I stepped on the scale. I think what I can make out is that it says 160. So it means I graduated high school at about 5'8", 160. So I was pretty small. Mm-hmm. But to go back to sort of your point, it's not like there weren't flashes of it. I remember a neighbor coming to my father and saying, your son has the potential to be a world-beating sprinter. And my father hung his head back and laughed like, like, there's no way, dude. Like, what? Like, I want some of what you've been drinking this morning. And of course, you know, Andre Walker, my ex-neighbor in Trinidad, he just tells the tale. And he tells anybody who listens, like, I saw that first, because he looked out of his window, must have been doing something in the sink, and he looks outside and he goes, look at this little kid just... Now, mind you, it didn't look like, you know, the fastest man in the world yet, but he had some track and field background. He looked out of his window and said, look at this kid just... And I was playing soccer. I was just, you know, like just having a little, what we call small goal in the Caribbean. We just set up, you know, the little goals on each side, and we get a little ball. And sometimes it's a tennis ball, depending on what we have. And he just saw me going back and forth, up and down, and thought, ooh, yeah, there is something that I am seeing. I don't know what it is. Yeah, and my dad thought that was hilarious. Of course, you know, we have both lived to sort of mock my father for not believing in me immediately.
Jumping on the train. If he were a typical, overbearing USA parent, they would have, signed you up right away and sent you off to IMG Academy or something.
Whatever's the opposite of that, that's what my dad is.
Yeah. So, I mean, clearly there's a genetic gateway to even dream of racing at NCAA Division I level or international level. And do you feel like there's a large number of kids that perhaps have that potential, but of course they never express it, they get diverted to other sports? Or do you really think, wait a second, if you want to break 10.00, we're talking about you got to bring so much to the first day of the track practice that most people are going to get lifted out?
Yeah, I think that that's not something that people are comfortable, especially not in 2023. I don't know that people are comfortable saying, look, as my old coach used to say, there's a reason why there's 100,000 seats in the stands and 8 lanes. That tells you, where, like, those people that make that final, and this is not just in the 100, but obviously the 100 is so specific an event that, yes, in his words as well, you are not getting a Clydesdale or a donkey to win the Kentucky Derby. So yes, there is an element of, it is born within you. And for people like me, I can look at a young child, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and tell the parent, there's something there if you want to, oh yeah, there's a, I got into coaching the last 8 years or so because of that sort of frustration of, wow, they don't even know what he or she is. And I can see it. And if that, if that kid gets developed the right way, the sky's the limit. So yeah, there is a huge genetic component. There is a huge, but I also think it's genetics plus other factors. I talked about me, growing up on a hill. Even at 5'8", 160, as I said in high school, I could dunk a basketball pretty comfortably. I didn't know I could. It took me moving to a new high school and kind of getting challenged by all the guys who were sick of, how high school is. The girls are like, oh my God, there's this new guy and he's got this accent. He's from like the Caribbean. He's like the fastest thing ever. And these guys were like, they had enough of hearing my name. And I am not a basketball player. And I was I must have been in gym class or something. They were like, bet you can't dunk. And I was like, ooh. And I grabbed
what
that
is dunking?
Ball. I saw that basketball hoop as recently as last week when I was in San Jose, because I went by my high school and I went and I looked and I thought, luckily for me, it probably was not 10 feet. I'm looking at it last week and I thought, this thing's probably been refurbished, 100 times since then. But if I had to guess on that day that I dunked my first time, it was probably 9'10", and the extra 2 inches is probably what saved me.
Oh, mercy. So you got to UCLA. You had somewhat of a cred because you're third in the state. So you were a recruit. You're looking for wonderful things to happen. I'm sure you were pretty focused and motivated by that time. You have a great program with great coaching. It worked out well for you, and maybe you could describe some of that journey. And then also, when we have a chance, because I know we can fill your brain with a lot of things, you're used to multitasking on the air. Here's this amazing phenomenon down in the Caribbean where the athletes are developed homegrown, and they pretty much dominate in terms of population comparison. And so I wonder what would have happened to the Otto that perhaps stayed on the islands through those formative years as an athlete.
Well, the first thing is that I didn't go directly to UCLA. I actually went to San Jose City College first, and there's a great sort of lesson/story in that, but I'll try to keep it brief. Bottom line is I got very big for my britches my senior year of high school.
Hey man, third in the states, no joke, people.
It wasn't even just because of that. I was living with my uncle at the time, who was like very well-to-do bachelor, and I had sort of fallen into his lifestyle and forgotten that I was a high school senior. And at the time I was actually supposed to go to USC, God forbid. And USC, I remember UCLA calling my mother, and they were like, there must've been a death in the family or something, because we've never seen somebody's GPA fall off this hard. I had good SATs. I think it was like 1,200. Yeah, I had 1,200 SAT scores, 1,270. Mm. Back when it was out of 1,600.
Mm.
So it wasn't that, but they were really concerned. They were like, "What? I just couldn't be bothered. It was like, it's too busy as soccer star, track star. It's too busy." And USC made me, they made me go to the junior college. And then the riots happened. And my mother was like, "Nope, you're not going out there." So I ended up 1 year, ended up being two. And then by then I met John Smith at the Olympics and ended up going to UCLA. But it's a good story because it's sort of my lose focus, get a little bit too cocky, a little bit too confident in life, kind of smacking me back down. It's actually the best thing that could have happened to me in retrospect, because I needed that at that time. But by the time I get to UCLA, though, I am so prepared. I don't lose in my junior and senior seasons at UCLA. I don't lose a single race to a collegian in anything. I think I took a loss to Mike Marsh, who was a pro at Mount SAC my junior year. I got him back. Got him back the next year with the Mount SAC relays record. By some miracle, I still have that meet record. It's probably one of the last three or four meet records I have. But yeah, no, by the time I get to UCLA, I'm laser focused. Mm-hmm. I've already been to the Olympics. There's the Olympics coming up in 96, which I know dang well I can be a factor in. And the pairing of me and John Smith, John is a very technical, very cerebral kind of coach that fits in directly in line with the way I want to be coached and the way I am best coached, I think. And the partnership results in collegiate records, school records that still stand 27 years later.
Oh yeah, they're carved. You see the carvings up on
and
top
those
of Drake
Stadium.
Records,
like, wait, the Pac-12 records are really not going anywhere now because that conference is about to dissolve.
Oh my goodness! Oh gosh, don't get us
even,
started.
Even though, in fairness, Andre DeGrasse got I think he got the 100 record, for the Pac-12.
Well, it was a good run, so to speak, for the Pac-12 in track and field, especially.
I can't even fathom in my mind not having that conference around. But
yeah,
you know, a lot of things that we saw for years. You know, their football games starting at 11 p.m. Eastern sometimes, sometimes later. It's like the country doesn't, you know, that network was always going. That I've worked for Pac-12 Network on many occasions. I've done many Pac-12 championships, but it's really a function of the geography too that has sort of killed off that conference. If you'd have told me 30 years ago that there's going to be in your lifetime, this conference will essentially dissolve, I'd have said no freaking way.
Yeah. Well, the money comes in, anything can happen. So you had this great career at UCLA, your position for the next Olympics where you got onto the podium and really took off. But behind the scenes, I'm not sure if a lot of fans are aware of how difficult it is to make a career as a professional track and field athlete, individual sport. You're not signing with the track and field 49ers. You're just Otto who won a bunch of races in college. So how does that transition? How did it work for you? John Smith was coaching at UCLA, and then he was also coaching the group that you joined. Or how does it work once you move past the college ranks?
Well, my junior year at UCLA, I got a bronze, which was my country's first medal at the World Championships of any color. And then it was also it made me the youngest at the time youngest man to medal in the 100 at World. So I was on a lot of shoe companies' radar.
Dang, too bad it wasn't during the NIL days, or you would have been styling on campus, man.
I had a conversation yesterday with Asante Samuel, the great former NFL cornerback that lives down here now. His daughter is a hurdle and sprint phenom. Mm. And we were saying the same thing. We were like, man, what would we have done in the era of NILs? I had done, because I had had that bronze already, the next year, you know, breaking the collegiate record, running the fastest time in the world to win the NCAAs and all that stuff. Somebody was going to sign me. It initially looked like Nike, and then I ended up signing with Reebok. I think I signed for like 150 grand a year. At the time, that was like, what? That was mind-blowing money. Now, if you are a college phenom, you could come out of university and get signed for almost $1 million if you're in a red event. 100 meter sprinter, absolutely, you'd be pushing $1 million. That's how much the sport has changed, plus inflation, from my era until now. So no, I would have been, I mean, in the way that John Godina, my teammate, would have been the number one pick the year before, in 95. He was world champion. He had broke the collegiate record just like me. I was that number one pick coming out in 96. There was no track athlete coming out that year that you could have pointed to and said, you know, this is somebody who would have been more in demand. But yeah, I couldn't wait. Got to the Olympics, got my two bronzes, really blew the 100. The 100 should have been silver at worst. The 200, I always say it's the most satisfying race of my career, because I wasn't finishing any higher than I did that night. Not beating 1932, and I remember I was a senior in high in university. People forget that.
Yeah.
Yes, I got the bronze in Atlanta. I was a senior in college at that time. You don't see a lot of college seniors getting sprint medals at that age. So I say that's my the medal I'm most comfortable with, because I wasn't beating Michael that year, that night. And I was not beating Frankie Fredericks. Both of those guys, I had looked up to them for all this time, because they're about 10 years older than I am. And then here I was in a race with them. I knew nobody else would beat me, and God knows I was gonna give it my all, and it was a personal best at the time. I think it's still the fastest I ever ran around a turn. But yeah, I wasn't beating those guys that night. So that's the one medal of the four Olympic medals that I have. That's the one I look at and I go, yeah, that's the one that you finished where you were seated. The other ones, you know, we can talk about, you know, maybe you could have run a little better. But for that night, I wasn't getting any higher than third that night.
You know, that's a really beautiful attitude. I think I'm going to jump in here where we're going to keep going with the storyline. But, you know, as a commentator and part of the production, it feels to me like this, especially with the USA mentality, you know, our obsession with the gold medals. And is Simone Biles going to get a bunch of more gold medals? And Michael Phelps going to get his 23rd and 24th gold medal? But here's your story of like, the most tremendous satisfaction of competing at the highest level against the greatest athletes that you looked up to, and, you know, to go home with the biggest smile with a bronze medal. I feel like it should be highlighted more, because sometimes people are, you know, coming through injuries and difficult times in their career. They want to give up. A lot of times track and field athletes, they aren't making the excellent income that the people at the very top make, and they come back and get fifth in the worlds, and no one even pays attention, but it's beautiful accomplishments all over the place.
Yeah, I think there was a part of me that always looked at the Olympics, and this is not a knock on NBC or ABC or whoever was covering the Olympics at the time. I could never have known before I got into the sport, into any Olympic sport, I happened to be in track and field, how difficult it is to stand on that podium. And I think that somehow there's some disconnect with an American audience where they feel like, well, you know, Simone Biles, she came out of the womb and she had this gift, and she's been doing push-ups since she was a fetus, and she's just better than everybody else. And it's like, oh, no, 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 no. So that's my job. And I think that's why I stay on a track almost every day if I could. I have to always remind myself, look, the person who's getting fifth, sixth, seventh in an Olympic final, in any Olympic final, is doing the same work, is busting their behinds, is crying, bleeding, sweating every day until this night, and maybe something doesn't go right, or who knows what happens. But you have to find a way to sort of give credit and honor everybody. Yes, of course, we have to tell stories, And the gold medalist story is usually the one that you're going to feature. But I'm telling you, man, we've had a guy like Karani James, for example. And Karani James, his coach literally passes away this year, Harvey Glantz, at practice coaching him. Ooh. The last thing he does was, you know, start Karani on his last run. He collapses. He never recovers. You try to tell me if that guy goes to Worlds and he gets a bronze or he gets fourth, that that's not going to... Of course it's going to come up. That's part of what sports is. That's what we celebrate. We celebrate, you know, the night that Brett Favre had that great game and his father had died and the Jordan flu game. Sports is about overcoming the stuff that life throws at us. So I'd like to think that when I got there, I mean, yes, we celebrate our medalists and certainly our gold medalists, but we continue to remind the audience, this is not easy. This is not, you don't fall out of bed and do this at this level. It requires a dedication and a commitment and a focus that really is the best of what humans can do.
Mm. I remember watching Usain Bolt false start in, what's the debut?
And 2011, like, South Korea.
Here comes another gold, baby. Let's see if he can break the record. And then everyone slapped in the face going, oh, this is a game of precision. And no, he cannot sit in the blocks for a half second to be safe and then beat everybody. He's going to get sixth if he does that. Oh, it's heavy, heavy stakes up there, man. Okay,
yeah,
so
the thing is that everybody's watching you. That's what everybody forgets. It's like, it's one thing if you're gonna, you know, attempt something in your office, and if you don't do it, well, you look left and right and nobody saw that. Yeah, how about can you do it with, you know, 5 billion people watching? That's the challenge of the Olympics. And that's why when people with Olympic credentials walk in the room, people almost genuflect. I have been in a room with a guy like Alberto Wantarena. Now I'm talking with our era, right?
Mm-hmm.
Alberto Wantarena, for your listeners, gets the double in the Olympics in 76, the 400 and the 800, and the 800 was first. Do you understand what that? So that's almost 50 years ago.
Wow.
I'm telling you, when a man walks into a room, people almost genuflect. Almost. That's how revered that sort of an accomplishment is.
Not to mention his times, which would still get him on the podium in the Olympics or World Championships in both events. Incredible.
I'm glad you completed that thought, because that's the more impressive thing. It's like a low altitude world record at the time in the four. And I think the 800 was like 143. It's nuts. And I think there were four rounds in both back then. It's like...
So... Yeah, just we're going back in time all that way and back to your career pattern, which was now a generation ago. Unlike some other sports where the competition has escalated like crazy, I would even argue the NFL, when you look at these guys 20 years ago to now, the level of athleticism. But what's your observation there, where we're looking at Bolt's time is now, what, 15 years old? Is it going to hold another 15, 20, 30 years? We have the high jump from Kostadinova that's held for, what, 40 years or something? And what about that progression or lack thereof in the various events?
Well, I think in part because I never got to play football. I am part of a company called Test Football, which has about... I think as we speak, about 70 NFL clients. So I have seen the NFL guys improve in my 15 years now in the business, because, you know, I see the linebackers that are like 4-4 low now, and I go, yeah. That's why I didn't play football, because I don't want him. Like, I look at Fred Warner and I go, yeah, I don't ever, or Dre Greenlaw, and I don't ever want somebody that size and that speed hitting me. I think similarly, just because of the advancements in training and knowledge and technology. I mean, these guys do stuff in training that I go, oh yeah, well, I would have loved to have done that.
Mm.
What's moving our sport ahead really quickly, I think, is the shoe technology, though. Because since the advent, I mean, certainly in the distances where it seems like there's a marathon world record every week, and a distance world record every month.
There's a girl running Olympic trials, USA Olympic men's trials qualifying time in the marathon now in this
right.
She was crazy.
Right. I mean, yeah. Faith Kipyegon's time is faster than the winning time in the 1500 in Rio.
Wolf.
Yeah, is that
that's right?
It's just this now the sprints have gone forward too, but I think if anything, it's testament to how good Bolt was that even with the advent of all this shoe technology, that 100 unchallenged. Now, the 200, I think, is not going. I think the 200's gonna go first. Because in Noah Lyles, he's already run 31. He's within 1/12 of a second. I think maybe, which is funny because at the time I thought those were the ones that were going to last longer. Mm-hmm. And now I look and I go, well, you know, it is harder to refine a pen than a tractor, right? So it makes sense that the 200 is the one, both on the women's and the men's side, that is getting approached. Meanwhile, the 100, not as much, certainly on the men's side. I think Bolt's going to lose that 200 meter record in the next 15 years. The 100, we'll see, because 9.58, that is going to take a special human being. I do not think Noah Lyles has another. I mean, he's 9.8 now, 9.8 low still. I don't know if he has another 2.5 tenths in him, I think. But I look at that 200 and I go, Noah can go faster, there's no question. To Bogo, who got silver at Worlds, who is younger than Noah, a lot younger, can go faster.
I'm so excited to introduce you to Paluva. This is a new zero-drop minimalist shoe with the distinctive five-toe design from my main man, Mark Sisson. Paluvas give you the most authentic barefoot-style experience, but with sufficient cushioning so you can use them for all manner of daily movement, especially walking and many other fitness and athletic activities. Paluvas are also incredibly stylish, so you get a barefoot shoe that you're not embarrassed to wear around in daily life. It's been so cool to see the popularity of minimalist shoes grow over the recent years, but Paluvas are a step ahead of every other zero-drop wide-box shoe because of the critical feature of individual five-toe articulation, a separate slot for each of your toes. This allows for correct dynamic movement of the foot through the walking or running stride, which is impossible when your toes are encased into a single box, even a wide box. Well, you might know that minimalist shoes have faced controversy in recent years for causing injuries from inappropriate use. So here is the big picture mission. We want to get you walking in Paluvas, living in your Paluvas, going barefoot in your home or other safe areas as often as possible. Go ahead and use your specialized cushiony running shoes or your basketball shoes, work boots, high heels, things that you want to wear when you want to wear them, but wear your Paluvas as much as possible to reawaken the natural functionality of the human foot to stand, walk, run, and perform. Do you want to try a pair? I'm certain that when you put them on and walk around, you are going to quickly realize that these are the most comfortable natural shoes that you've ever worn. They are designed to feel like you're, quote, walking barefoot on a putting green. Please visit Paluva.com, that's P-E-L-U-V-A, and use the code BRADPODCAST and get 10% off your first pair. Paluvas, let your feet be feet.
Arian Knighton, the U.S. phenom, who's already run 19.4, he can go faster. So there's enough young talent in that event where I think the 200 men's world record will go before the 100.
So speaking of Bolt, the transcendent athlete, mostly we immediately see his height, but I feel like you're going to tell me there's a lot more to it than just being tall. And one of the things I want to ask you about specifically is this characterization that he was lazy in workouts and had to get goaded to complete the whole workout. And I reflect on that, especially coming from the triathlon scene where we overtrained like crazy, and the people who got a little bit smarter and learned how to rest a little bit would rise up rather than, you know, just keep banging your head against the wall. Maybe that was a positive attribute where The highest progression or the evolution of athletic training is the guy who's dancing in the clubs in the off season to help recalibrate from that intensity of working so hard when it's time to peak for a major meet.
I've had enough conversations. He and I, for some reason, have just ended up in extended in places where we are not separated for extended periods of time. Airport lounges, aircraft adjacent seats. So I have talked to him enough. The last time I sat next to him for an extended time, we were both on the same flight going into Worlds last year in Eugene. And I certainly was not a coach of his sort of level, but I have a couple world titles of my own, albeit juniors. I think I sifted through what he said and what he wanted to say to me enough to know this. Look, Usain Bolt is an incredibly gifted athlete. The guys who do that kind of stuff for a living in terms of technique and you know, stride length and stride frequency and all that stuff say he's the best ever. Like, born onto this earth, genetic freak. But his coach essentially would tell you and told me, it was a question. Yes, he loved the party. That doesn't make him uncommon as a young Jamaican male. Yes, he loved the party. Yes, he loved nightlife and all that. But he said he worked very hard. There's no way you don't and get those kinds of results. He just, I think, would like to have seen him string together more years of consistent training and maybe listen to him a little bit more in terms of how to attack that 200. He felt like he should have been either 19-1 low or maybe 19-0 if he'd have done it his way. And he feels like the reason why people are getting close is because maybe Usain did it more the Usain way than the Glenn Mills way. But I consider myself fortunate, just for my own track and field loving eyes, as well as for my career, that I got to be around for his career, because I got to see things that I, as a sprinter, only dreamed about it, you know, at a pro at pro dimensions of 5'9", 175. To see a guy that height, and I know a lot of people go, oh yeah, well, he's tall. There's not a lot of tall guys that have run those sorts of times. His genetic gift is he has that height. He's 6'5", but he has the ability to turn over that big wheel with the speed of somebody my height. So, you know, Proud Mary, big wheel, keep on turning. When a big wheel is turning, it is going to consume lots of ground. It's going to swallow ground with each revolution. You combine that with the ability to turn that wheel over very quickly, and you have 1919 and 1958 and the way that he revolutionized both of those events. So that's the way I try to describe it for people who are not as into all the minutia of sprinting as I am.
But the technique at the highest level is so crucial, and there's so much behind that where you're not really getting in the blocks and going 100% and fighting to the finish. So maybe you could talk a little about that and how you and John Smith and the rest of your group there in Los Angeles were, you know, became the ultimate technicians, helped kind of evolve things like the drive phase and all this terminology that you cough up during the meets, which are so important to understand that, you know, it's not guys just racing each other to the ice cream truck. It's very nuanced.
Yeah, if you look at like early Santa Monica in the mid to late 80s, you can see elements of it. They did not have their eyes fixed on the finish line in the 100 in the first maybe 2, 3, 4 steps. My coach was around that because he was a coach at Santa Monica, and then he sort of broke off and did his own thing. And I remember my junior year, we were working on this thing called 7 steps. And it was that you were going to stay. And I remember, you know, him giving me the examples, your car stalls on the freeway and you have to push it. Think of the angle that you want to push it from. And that's the angle we're going to push from. And that made it very relatable to all of us in terms of, you know, how you would approach that angle, that relative angle. And I think I was really the beneficiary of myself and Maurice. I think it's why we had such good drive phases, is because we came to John right when he had to figure that out. And because he had to figure it out at a very preliminary stage, he was able to sort of teach us as he was learning it. So 95, I look back at like my Pac-10 back then championships. And yeah, I look different to everybody else in the race. Everybody else is just kind of standing straight up as everybody else would do back then. And you can see me doing my seven steps. By the next year, it's turned into this thing called the drive phase, which of course everybody in track and field knows what that is now, and they know what it looks like. But we were working on it back then and working on maybe extending it out a little further. And it's so funny to me to go all over the world now and watch people do that technique. And I look sometimes, and just to myself, I go, look at this thing that we were literally at UCLA piecing together. I guess this is how Dick Fosbury used to feel, where he goes, look at the rest of the planet doing this thing that I conceived in my head, or that I perfected in my head. That's how it feels for me when I see people, like when I watch Christian Coleman, I go, geez, like that is the evolution of whatever it is we thought we were trying to do 30 years ago, because he has such a phenomenal start. But yeah, it was exciting to be, you know, around this culture was literally changing the event forever.
So you had this wonderful run at the top, 8 global medals, your peak years on the circuit. And then I think you had some misfortune, injuries, automobile accident, and you maybe it was an early end. You can talk about that, but then tell us how your career wrapped up and transitioned.
Yeah, by 02, so now I am, 29. In 02, I have a drunk driver hits me head-on in Trinidad, and that is effectively the end of my career, even though I don't retire for another, 16 months. But before that, in 99, I was injured. I had a hamstring injury, and I could not compete at the Seville World Championships that year. Maurice Green would win the 100 and the 200 that meet, but my broadcast career effectively started there. I wanted to, you know, sit at home and feel sorry for myself in Los Angeles. My manager said, hell no, you will pack several suits and you will come here. You know how when we go to the fights in Vegas, how all the fighters are there? Well, this is a world championship. You will come. And I was like, ugh. Got on the plane very reluctantly. And the BBC said, oh, he's here. He's obviously not running. Does he want to come sit in? It's funny because somebody made me look up that the reviews from that show. And the review literally says that coverage has been otherwise, not noteworthy, except for this kid that they brought on. I thought, wow, I've never seen that. And now I'm 20 years into my own broadcast career. So I went on the BBC, and the reviews were good. And you know, that's not a bad thing to be able to put at the top of your resume once I retire. So got injured in 02. And then by 04, I got my 4x1 team to the finals of the Olympics. And I said, yep, that's it. I'm 30. I'm out. And everybody said, oh, please, you'll be back next. And I went, nope, I'm done. I didn't like being injured all the time. And post-accident, I was never the same. Every time I'd get the top end speed, something would feel like it's coming undone. It, you know, the leg never healed right. It was twisted. I don't know. But whatever, I know for sure that on that day in July in 02, that was the end of my career. I didn't figure it out until, as I said, 16 months later. So yeah, I walked away and didn't know what the heck I was going to do. Got into politics the year after. I was a senator very briefly. And then when CBS came calling to do the NCAAs that year from, I believe, Sacramento in 05, that was it. I was in. I bothered NBC for about 2 more years. And they, I don't know if at the time they thought they were going to hire me or not, but they were very content to let CBS groom me. And I started to do some ESPN stuff at the time too, just here and there. And then in 07, NBC came calling, and my first Olympics was 08. The rest is history.
Well, so you had a bit of a break. You got on the air in Seville to great reviews, and then you tried to race for a few more years, get involved in politics. Were you doing any commentating or practicing at home during that time?
Nope. So in 99, just for that, you know, that week they had me, and I wasn't calling races. And I know that sometimes to the layperson, it seemed like the same thing. The people who, there is one level of the sport where, you know, I'm in the studio and I say, yeah, I think the 49ers are going to win today because they're playing blah, blah, blah. That is one level of broadcasting in sports. Mm. The top level is what Troy Aikman does. It's what Tony Romo does. It's what I do. There's a difference between that and actually calling a game. The preparation is completely different. Mm. In a studio, you don't have to prep the same way. So yeah, between 99 and 05, I did a little bit of, because what I remember what happened is that in 2000, for example, the BBC covers the Olympic trials for the US. So I remember being in Sacramento. I actually interviewed Marion Jones in Sacramento at the Olympic trials in 2008. I also remember, in 2000, yeah, because it would have been the year after Seville. So it was 2000 Olympics. I remember interviewing Marion Jones in 2000 before the whole drive for five, before that whole thing fell apart. So, but it was like I was doing one thing a year, two things a year. It wasn't like I had, you know, I was churning them out. So, and then even when I was doing the NCAAs, 05 and 06, that was one meet a year. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like I was getting a lot of reps. Once NBC hires me in the summer of 07, then I'm working quite a bit. And then, of course, from 08, then I'm doing everything. So, yeah, it was kind of few and far between at the time. And that used to hurt me because I used to feel like it took me the first hour to really warm up and get back into my groove. I don't know how I did that. Now I love doing the Diamond League because it keeps me sharp. It's like, yeah, I remember it happened, you know, last Wednesday, last Friday. I can't imagine now being able, having to do pro meets without like doing a meet every week, because it does. There is a sharpness that you keep when you broadcast, once a week, twice a week.
So I guess you sort of felt like a natural when you just stepped on to the, wrapped up the, put on the mic in 99. But when you started to see this as a viable career opportunity, what is your methodology? I mean, as a sprinter, you're going into extremely precise and focused preparation. How does that translate over to announcing, or are you just the natural and you sit on the beach and then get on the plane and start talking about athletes?
Yeah, right. I think I come from a family of talkers, the kind of guys and women, my aunts, who you can put them on a stage and they will have an audience kind of in their palm for an hour on any subject. That's the kind of family I come from. So this is not something that's unique to me. And I'm always very observant of that. Having said that, though, I think your ego allows you to think that somehow you are gifted enough where everything that proceeds out of your mouth is somehow going to be relevant or interesting or necessary. So you spend the first 3 to 4 to 5 years, I think, of any broadcast career, and certainly I did, trying to sound like the television version of yourself, the voice of the version of yourself that exists in your head. I think only in the last 5 or 6 years of my career are people getting my authentic self. And it's funny because people who have been listening to me for 20 years goes, man, I've never heard you like this before. It's like, it feels like you're having fun for the first time. It feels like something's changed. And I think to myself, I have to credit my producer who said, I really want the version of you that maybe we get in production meetings, that we get in the car ride. I mean, maybe without all the expletives, but I want you to be that sort of you know, uber fan, uber knowledgeable. There's nothing that you're going to see that you haven't yourself been through and you can't convey to the audience. And that changed all of how I broadcast, because I think that there is an element of, oh, I mean, like, what am I going to see that I can't? Like, and you realize, no, broadcasting, particularly in America, where you're always headed to commercial at some point. There is, yeah, I mean, look, on the BBC, you aren't going to commercial. So if you have an extended thought and it gets a little long and you, it's fine because you're not going to commercial. You know, you have to make room for somebody else to talk. But in the States, you're always going to commercial. And I think for that, I had to learn when the best thing you can say right in this moment is absolutely nothing. If you'd have told me that the first Yaz broadcast, I was like, what? No. I have to say something here. Look, it's a big, no. Because your voice can't add to it. What just happened on this track, just let it breathe. Let it breathe for 30 seconds and you tell me if that doesn't look better 15 years from now or 15 minutes from now. Mm-hmm. I had to be convinced of that because, I think a lot of very talented broadcasters get into the booth and they go, I know this sport, I've lived this sport, and there's nothing that's going to happen that I can't express. It's like, okay, good. That doesn't mean that we need to hear that every... Look, I'm a big Tony Romo fan, and I feel like that's kind of... Because early Tony Romo, I used to enjoy on a level where I went, oh my gosh, and I'm like, oh, and he's my category at the Emmys, and he just made my category that much harder, and all of that stuff. And I feel like in the last couple of years, I'm like, no, this is not the Tony that we had before. I feel like he's gonna have a resurgence in his career because he's such a talented broadcaster. I just feel like he's gotten off on one of these tangents that maybe I did when I was at that stage in my career, and somebody's gonna like set him straight. And I've seen some of the criticism that he's taken over the last, I don't know, season or two. And I go and I think, yeah, no, he'll be back because I think. Yeah, there's a tendency to feel like, oh yeah, I can go in there and just ad lib or whatever, and it's all gonna be great because it's coming out of my mouth. That would be a huge mistake.
Well, that's really well put. I mean, you don't want to be putting on a show. You want to be the real you.
Yes.
However, you are putting on a show, and yes. you're entertaining the audience. So you have to kind of straddle that fine line. That's
fine. It's a razor's edge. It's that fine.
Now, do you do like the NBA referee type of recap where they show them every call they made and they score them on a percentage score? Yeah, it's gnarly. I mean, they put together a highlights tape of every time you blew the whistle, and they give you, you know, you have to be 86% or higher with your correction, otherwise you go get relegated. But I wonder if you. I mean, this could be like a personal preference, but are you scrutinizing your own broadcasts, or have you had enough of Eugene after 8 days and want to get your head clear?
There's certain rules to when to how things look on television. Sometimes things don't go well, or there's a mistake that you make or somebody makes, and you think, oh my gosh, how's this happening on live television? You go home, and if it was in your head, it was a 10. When you actually watch it live on the air, sometimes it's a 3, sometimes it's a 4, it's a 5. Okay. It's almost never, unless you mistakenly drop an F-bomb or something, it's never going to be as bad in real life as it was in your head. That's the first thing. The second thing for me is that nobody's going to critique, look, nobody's going to critique themselves harder than I will. I don't ignore criticism. There's sometimes that somebody will somehow get a direct message to me or some kind of comment to me, and I go, oh, that's complete BS. But there's other times where somebody goes, hey, your 200 meter calls, you're saying the same thing for the whole meeting. I go, ooh. And you go back and I go, yeah, I can't. And not only will I do it, I will go to my colleagues in the booth and say, hey, we're doing this the same way every time. I've really made it a point. Don't get comfortable. Don't get enamored with your last meet. Don't get enamored with your last call, so that we do not fall into some of the traps I think that a lot of broadcasters fall into, you know. And don't get in love with the sound of your own voice. That's the number one thing. It's like, sometimes shutting up is fine too.
Well said, man. you know, one of the things that's you're really commended for, and the allure of listening to, is you have that that high level information experience, and also the it feels like you know these athletes. I know you travel with them, spend a lot of time with them, and you provide that you know, that backroom info. Now, is that sort of a nuanced thing where you're hanging out with these people and you say, how's your training going? Well, I broke it with my boyfriend. He's been a real asshole. And so my training's struggling. And you're going to kind of try to have the audience get to know these people that are friends and personal, you know, coworkers. How do you deal with that?
You don't know how dead on that question is, particularly with the boyfriend thing. It is a fine line. I have not always played it perfectly. I'll tell you what happens to me sometimes. I will be, there's very little in this industry that I don't know way in advance. Coaching change, breakup, because the coaches are all my friends, the agents are all my friends, and yes, I have great relationships with most of the athletes. So I get fed all this information on, especially during the season. And I have to sometimes remember, oh, this is for broadcast use. You're not supposed to know this at all. And occasionally in the heat of the moment, I think, is it last year? Yeah, last year, I leaked something. And it wasn't a huge deal if you weren't the athlete. But essentially, I was saying, look, so-and-so athlete is about to switch to this event, and I wasn't supposed to be out yet. It turned out being a good thing because the meet promoters all went, oh my gosh, well, if that's the case, then I want them in my meet next year, blah, blah, blah. But yes, there is a very fine line that I have to walk between what I'm supposed to know, what I can reveal, and, you know, the other things that I have to keep. I mean, there's big drug busts that are coming that I know months in advance, and it's like, hey, if this leaks, we're coming to you because you are the only person that knows this other than, you know, the agent and the coach or whatever. So yeah, it is interesting being me sometimes, because I look at my phone and I'm like, oh yeah, you know who that is? That's so-and-so executive from this shoe company asking me if, you know, what's the barometer out there for athlete X that they're thinking of signing? Mm. Yeah, it's sometimes very interesting to be me because of sort of where I sit in the sport, but I don't take it for granted. And I'm glad that you think that, you know, I have all this knowledge. It's not because I'm doing that like, you know, oh, I want to prepare because I'm an analyst. That's because I genuinely love the sport. It's almost like the Rosie Perez character in White Men Can't Jump. That was like, you have to get me on Jeopardy because I have all this stuff in my head. What am I going to do with it? I have to get on Jeopardy. That's how I am with my track and field stats and knowledge and Olympic history. It was like, I might as well be on television because I have all of this stuff in my head from, you know, dating back to 1936 and before. So it I am lucky that I am employed in a job where I get to use all the stuff in my head.
If you weren't, you'd probably be on YouTube building the Otto network and taking viewers away from NBC. So everybody wins here, man. Everybody wins. So what is the schedule like? I mean, do you have you must feel like you're still an athlete heading to all these meets? Do you get butterflies before the cameras turn on? Is it a good proxy for what you did before? Do you just feel comfortable moving on to a whole different experience in life?
My generation of broadcasters is the first that we have not. Look, we'll go to the Olympic trials, Olympics, the big ones, Prefontaine, right? The ones that are domestic in the United States. We don't do that Diamond League circuit anymore. We don't do it by following we don't have to travel with them. One of the things that the pandemic produced is the ability to broadcast from home. So when you hear me do doing a Diamond League broadcast, I am sitting right where I am right now.
Not in Qatar. Oh my goodness.
I'm on a VPN. I'm on a VPN back to Stamford, Connecticut, which is our headquarters, and we are broadcasting sometimes live
on like a 3 or 5 second delay, and one guy's in Eugene and the distance analyst is in Michigan or Iowa somewhere, and I'm in Florida, and we are doing a live, and the producer and everybody else is in Stamford, Connecticut, and we are doing a live broadcast. So that has, I mean, that has changed my world, because I used to always have to get on a plane to go. At first it was LA, and then it was Denver, and then it was Stamford, Connecticut. Now we do our production meetings on Zoom. We fire up our, I just sent the equipment back a couple days ago. We they send me a kit. I connect it to my router, and I'm broadcasting from home. So that part has made my life a lot easier.
Mm. And you get to pursue your coaching passion as well. So
right.
Tell us about
certainly in the first 3 months of the year when I'm, you know, that's my time for my NFL to be guys. Yeah, it allows me to not have to leave. You know, I can work those guys out all day. And not that there's a lot of Diamond League meets going on at that time of the year, but you know, occasionally there's a world indoors or something like that that I have to call. It means that I don't have to leave town, which is which is great. It's the greatest blessing that my sport has given me. I have seen the world, man, because of, you know, there's always some track meet in, you know, in some corner of the world. But I like being at home now.
Well, yeah, you've earned some home time, and
yes.
There's no decline on the broadcast quality, so I didn't even know that was happening.
Yeah.
Otto, I appreciate you so much on behalf of all track and field fans. You're doing a great job. Keep up, keep promoting the sport.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me, and I look forward to seeing you out there at the meets again, or jumping on the plane and bumping into my favorite broadcaster.
Great to be on with you, man. All the best to you as well.
Thank you, Otto. That's a wrap, people. Ch-ch-ch.
I'm pleased to present BRAD Grass-Fed Whey Protein Isolate Superfuel, the absolute highest quality, all-natural protein supplement infused with creatine that delivers everything you need to optimize your appetite for fat loss, recover quickly from workouts, and build and maintain lean muscle mass, the single most important attribute for aging gracefully. Our protein comes directly from small family farms in America's dairy land of Wisconsin. It's cold processed and microfiltered for maximum bioavailability and digestibility. So please don't mess with the many cheap commodity protein supplements that are ineffective, inferior, less pure, and often contain junk sweeteners, especially the plant-based offerings that are vastly less bioavailable than the gold standard of protein supplements, that's whey protein isolate. Whether you're in your peak athletic years looking to grow and recover, or in the older age groups trying to delay aging and decline, whey and creatine are widely agreed to be the most critical and effective supplements to take for the rest of your life. You can easily stir the superfuel in water or make a delicious smoothie every day. I'm certain that you're going to love the pleasant, light, natural vanilla bean and cocoa bean flavors. So try some on Amazon today. It's a huge hit with dozens of 5-star reviews. Or you can order direct from bradnutrition.com with our buy 3, get 1 free, and make the superfuel a centerpiece of your daily routine.
Thank you so much for listening to the BRAD podcast. We appreciate all feedback and suggestions. Email podcast@bradventures.com and visit bradkearns.com to download 5 free ebooks and learn some great long cuts to a longer life, how to optimize testosterone naturally, become a dark chocolate connoisseur, and transition to a barefoot and minimalist shoe lifestyle.